You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon, and thank you for making the time and being here with us. My name is Moises Naim. I'm a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment. It is my great pleasure to welcome you, but also to welcome Lael Brainard. She needs no introduction. She has had many important jobs. Perhaps the most important one was when she was our neighbor next door at Brookings, and we got to talk. Lael Brainard has had a long and distinguished experience. She serves as the Deputy National Economic Advisor and Deputy Assistant to the President in International Economics during the Clinton administration, at the time in which the Asian crisis erupted, and she played an important role there. She also was an important protagonist during China's access, the negotiations that led to China's access to the World Trade Organization. She has served as the Sherpa to the G8. As you know, she is now the Undersecretary for International Affairs at the Department of Treasury, where she is also the Sherpa for the G20. We are going to have a free-flowing conversation. I'm going to have a conversation with Dr. Brainard, and then open it up to your questions. We're going to cover a lot of issues in the short 1 hour that we have. I think that the plan is to chat a little bit about trends in the global economy, get Dr. Brainard's outlook on the global economy, which is the context for a lot of the negotiations and meetings that are taking place and will be taking place in the weeks ahead. So, and then, as I said, then we will welcome your questions and comments. So, let's start with the global economic outlook. And there's a lot going on. There's a lot of volatility. The IMF last week trimmed its forecast for the fifth time since last year for global growth. It brought it down for this year from 3.5% growth to 3.1, and is also more pessimistic or less sanguine about growth in 2014. It had said that it was going to be about 4%. Now it says it's 3.8, but it points out and emphasizes all of the downward pressures. And last week and the week prior, we saw an extreme volatility in exchange rates around the world and also a lot of action in interest rates. Tell us a little bit about that context, about exchange rate volatility, growth, and interest rates and all that.
Yeah, I think if you look across the global landscape, there are reasons to be concerned that some parts of the world aren't doing enough to bolster domestic demand. You know, for our part, I think we go into international discussions at a stronger point than we've seen at any time in the last 4 years. You know, we have taken a number of extraordinarily important actions early to make sure that our banks would be compelled to build capital, strengthen their balance sheets. They've gone through very substantial deleveraging and have now been lending to the private sector for 9 consecutive quarters. Our household sector has deleveraged. The housing market has turned around, and that owes to decisive, continued support for private demand and a willingness to do a course correction when we were seeing headwinds from abroad to provide additional support in the form of the payroll tax cut. And so I think, you know, generally speaking, the U.S. Overall picture is one where we're meeting our deficit goals and we're doing so at a time when the private sector has sufficient underlying momentum of demand. But if you look around the world, there are risks of protracted stagnation, most importantly, in Europe, which accounts for 1/5 of global demand. And so, you know, obviously it's important to the world, it's important to Europe, and it's important to the U.S. to see stronger action there to support demand. I think if you look at the question that you raised, you know, we have seen some return of volatility to more normal levels following a period of abnormally low volatility. I think it would just be normal to anticipate that as private market participants look to the eventual normalization of global financial conditions, it would be only natural to see some of that a kind of adjustment in markets.
And it's not just Europe that it's a cause of concern. Now we have, in terms of its lack of growth, and it's no longer a contributor to global growth, but it's, of course, the emerging markets, the BRICS, and especially China. A few hours ago, the governor of the Central Bank of China, Zhu Xiaoxuan, stated that concerning China, he said the domestic economic situation is unusually complex. There are many unstable, uncertain factors and quite large downward pressures on the economy. So if you have a stagnant Europe and declining growth in China and other BRICS, we also saw the same thing in Brazil, we see it in India and others. Who, you know, where is the engine? Where is the dynamism going to come?
Well,
from?
Of course, you know, we last week had an opportunity to spend quite sustained, in-depth time with our Chinese colleagues, and it is the case that China's new leaders are confronting a complicated set of challenges on the economic front. They confront both the need to undertake deep structural reforms to get their economy onto a path that's driven by the domestic consumer and much less reliant on a no longer sustainable pattern of overinvestment in resource-intensive industries oriented for export. And they face that at the same time that they have to work through some of the excesses in credit markets that have developed over the last few years. So, you know, I think for us, it's very important to see China undertaking policies, for instance, allowing the exchange rate to move to market-determined levels, for instance, opening up their capital markets and allowing financial market liberalization to take place. I think China's new team understands these challenges. We expect to see continued movement on those fronts. But the one thing I will say is they did come to Washington already prepared to make some important changes. For instance, in the arena of the bilateral investment treaty.
What's your answer when they say, we want to do all of these changes and opening up the capital account and having a different kind of exchange rate, but this is the worst possible moment to do it? This is too risky. There are too many headwinds and too many risks to start adding the uncertainty associated with wholesale, you know, large-scale reforms.
Well, in fact, I think the message that we're hearing is these are precisely the kinds of reforms that they know are now necessary to unlock their domestic consumer, to raise the purchasing power of domestic consumers, to move them off a pattern of growth with an undervalued exchange rate and, you know, workers who had lower purchasing power. You ended up with a pattern of growth that was very resource intensive, very heavily dependent on very, very high levels of investment in the economy. And that's precisely the pattern they're actually trying to move away from, with some of the indications being that they want to open up their investment regime, for instance. And that's why the move on the bilateral investment treaty was really a breakthrough.
Why?
Essentially, what we are hearing from our Chinese colleagues is that they are ready for the first time to enter into negotiations on a bilateral investment treaty that puts all sectors and all stages of investment, including the pre-establishment phase, on the table. That essentially implies a fundamental reversal from a long period in which every investment in the Chinese economy needed to be approved, and where most of the services sectors were restricted, were off the table altogether. And so when the new leadership in China says they need a more dynamic services sector, of course, foreign U.S. services companies who are revolutionizing services delivery all over the world have a lot to bring to bear. That's why it both provides big opportunities here for U.S. companies, but it'll also provide important opportunities for China's consumers.
And last week in those negotiations or conversations, that dialogue with China, you also dealt with a very controversial issue these days, which is cybersecurity, intellectual property. Tell us something about that.
Yeah, so there too, the president has put this top of the agenda. The business community, not just in the U.S. but around the world, is saying this is now their number one concern. And I think the discussion with our Chinese colleagues has actually evolved in a positive direction in the sense that we're now clearly focused on the problem of cyber intrusions by government-sponsored entities, cyber intrusions that really lead to the theft of intellectual property, be it trade secrets or commercial intelligence. Different mode of essentially the same problem that we've been having some progress addressing, which is the issue of intellectual property. I think Chinese policymakers on the economic side understand that their goals of moving to a high-value economy are also going to be importantly served by having much stronger intellectual property enforcement of all types.
We will get back to the conversation about China, but also this morning you met, let's talk about Europe. This morning you met with Secretary Liu, you met with Michel Barnier, who is the European Union's commissioner for internal market and services. This is in the context of your negotiations, of the U.S. negotiations about the European free trade agreement with Europe and all of the issues that are there. Would you share with us the content, a little bit about those?
Sure. So, we were delighted to meet with Commissioner Barnier, and really we had a full conversation about all the aspects of financial reform that both the U.S. and the EU are in the throes of implementing in both of their markets. We've done a lot in a short period of time. So if you look just at these past few months, the U.S. has gone final on Basel III. They've proposed tougher leverage ratios. We now have the CFTC concluding its cross-border rules on regulating derivatives transactions for the first time, and concluding a very important bilateral agreement with the European Commission just at the end of last week. We've seen now in the U.S. context, the FSOC has designated some systemically important non-banks. So our financial reform agenda is moving along at a very rapid clip, very much consistent with the commitments that we've made in the G20 and the FSB, as well as the statutory responsibilities we have under Dodd-Frank. With regard to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, we had the first round of discussions on Friday here in Washington. They proceeded very well, and we have a lot of enthusiasm for those discussions more generally. On the financial services front, we think that there is some work that we can do that would be very beneficial in market access. In the financial reform agenda, we are already doing that work in real time today, and what we don't want to see is a trade agreement getting in the way of implementation, and particularly serving as an excuse to delay implementation of financial reforms that have already been committed on very ambitious deadlines that are immediately before us. And that's why the agreement, for instance, between the EU and the U.S., last Thursday was extremely important. Why wait? We've already got these commitments. Let's get it done now.
Give us some details about those agreements.
So in the case of derivatives, for the first time, we have a comprehensive set of rules in place that will really increase transparency, bring derivatives out of the shadows, create market incentives for those derivatives to be centrally cleared and traded on trading platforms. We will have now agreement between the U.S. and the EU so that we have a consistent set of rules on both sides of the Atlantic, and thereby essentially getting rid of any opportunities that financial market participants might otherwise have exploited for regulatory arbitrage. So this is a very significant step forward, and one that is directly responsive to some of the most detrimental aspects of our financial landscape prior to the crisis.
I'm sure that in your conversations with Commissioner Barnier, you touched on the sticking points on the complicated issue in trade negotiations between the EU and the U.S. that have to do with agriculture, of course, the cultural exception, the trade in films and so on, and subsidies.
So I think those issues are ones that are being dealt with between our trade negotiators, and obviously the president's been very clear that he wants a very robust package. In our discussions with our European counterparts, in particular Secretary Liu's discussions with Commissioner Barnier this morning, we were much more narrowly focused on what Europe is doing to make sure that its financial system is safer and sounder, that banks have strong balance sheets and get back into the business of lending to small and medium-sized enterprises. So I'll say that a lot of the conversation was focused on what's the fate of the single resolution mechanism and how far will that go in the euro area? Where are the Europeans on their resolution directive? You know, we now have a very strong orderly liquidation authority in the United States that allows U.S. authorities to liquidate or to resolve any large financial institution in a way that preserves orderly functioning of markets. We need a counterpart in Europe to be able to do that on a cross-border basis. And so the pace at which Europe moves forward on its resolution regime matters here in the U.S. And so those are the areas where we really want to see progress in real time.
Hard to talk about Europe and its reforms without talking about economic growth in Europe, and that brings it to the inevitable conversation about austerity and growth. And you have been commenting about that, and tell us your perspective on, you know, the whole notion that there is austerity fatigue in Europe, that austerity has run its course, and now a more aggressive, stimulative set of policies are necessary.
Yeah, we really believe it's important for Europe to move forward on a plan for boosting demand, a growth plan. We, I think, have tremendous respect for the European authorities in terms of the distance they've come and their real achievements on financial stability. They have come together around a new set of financial instruments. We've seen the ECB working together with European leaders to support governments undertaking very difficult reforms. But as we know from our own financial crisis, financial stability is the first part of crisis response. We really then embarked on a very strong set of efforts to strengthen private demand. And we think that is extraordinarily important for Europe to avoid a protracted period of stagnation with very high unemployment that we're starting to see in the periphery. And the kind of fatigue that you are mentioning. So, you know, we think there are important areas that will help to strengthen demand. Obviously, coming together around new ways of getting credit to small and medium-sized enterprises is an area that Europe has been talking about that we strongly support. We also think it's very important if you look at the pattern of recovery. In Europe, it has occurred. Demand is still below pre-crisis levels, and the recovery that's taken place has done so primarily through export channels. Well, you have economies sitting at the center of Europe that have went into the crisis and still have surpluses of 6% of GDP or more. There's more they can do on demand. What we know from our own crisis is you need to do course corrections as you go. Again, you know, we had a fiscal trajectory. We went back to Congress and worked together to secure the payroll tax cut when our trajectory was threatened by headwinds from abroad. So being willing to make adjustments as you go is an extremely important part of a sustained and sustainable demand and growth plan.
So this is the context that in which you, on Thursday, you are going to Moscow. to the G20, and you have been, you are the Sherpa, you have been deeply involved in the preparations for this G20. Tell us a little bit what to expect, and also explain to us how is this G20 different from preceding ones?
Yeah. Well, one of the important ways this G20 is different is we'll have finance ministers and labor ministers sitting side by side for the first time. And we think that is significant because, again, it really puts the jobs and demand agenda at the heart of our macroeconomic discussions in the G20. More generally, we think it's extraordinarily important for G20 economies to move forward, to strengthen demand. Again, the U.S. comes to this in a stronger position, I think, than we've seen at any time in the G20 meetings up to this point, with a very good story to tell in terms of lessons learned from our response on the financial crisis and the recovery plan that has supported growth and jobs in the U.S. We'll want to hear from our Chinese colleagues how they're going to support demand, very importantly from our European colleagues, and of course from Japan as well, how their growth plan will work through domestic demand channels.
So your questions and comments, please raise your hand, and we have... not all at the same time. I think we have colleagues with microphones and the usual procedure. Please tell us your name and your institutional affiliation. Go ahead, please. Let's wait until the microphone gets to you.
Thank you. Jennifer Liu with Hong Kong Phoenix TV. Question about the SNED last week. So as you mentioned, the economic growth has been the focus during the discussion. And we know China is facing a difficult choice between a structural reform and economic growth. So based on your interaction with the China counterpart and your understanding, do you think the China government will be willing to sacrifice the short-term economic growth in order to achieve the long-term structural reform? Thank you.
Well, I think in our discussions, we did not see a trade-off. We really saw that the path forward for China to maintain rising living standards and growth is to take on this very challenging set of reforms that will further the reform and opening up process. And so, you know, we saw in the discussion of the bilateral investment treaty that they understand that moving from a restricted list approach to a approach that assumes all of the services sectors are on the table, unless there are very narrow and transparently negotiated exceptions, that's a very important change that we think is both enhancing to growth in China, but also provide some important opportunities more broadly. We heard about their plans for launching a Shanghai Free Trade and Investment Zone, which also will allow enterprises of all types, foreign and domestic, to compete for the first time on equal terms. And again, will it bring some competition and some dynamism to the services sectors, which is good for China, good for the world. We heard that they want to move forward in the areas of liberalizing interest rates so that credit is not allocated disproportionately to state enterprises, but is made more broadly available to the most dynamic enterprises. We heard about their plans to move further on the market determination of exchange rates and liberalization of their capital account. If you look across the set of changes to state enterprises that are being debated now in China, all of those things will move away from a very resource-intensive model and a model that is no longer sustainable for China to a model that is cleaner and more promising for China's domestic consumer and, of course, for Americans and for the world, promises a more balanced growth path and one that creates more opportunities globally.
Thank you. Let me take someone from the back over there. Yes, that.
Thank you. Jo Marie Griesgraber, New Rules for Global Finance. Delighted you're the Sherpa, Lael. First, I want to say I'm delighted that the U.S.-EU trade agreement is anticipating putting the brakes on some of that international trade and finance agenda. I'm hoping that the Trans-Pacific Partnership does the same thing because of the tension between trade agreements and domestic regulation. I do want to ask you about the postponement of FATCA that was just announced, that we see closing down some of the tax havens overseas and the need for similar tax policies. And the U.S. has done a great job in proposing FATCA. Now we've just put the brakes on it again. So could you address that, please?
Yeah, so let me just be clear.
Please give some context to the question for people that...
Yeah, so the U.S. Has put forward, I think, what has become now widely taken up internationally as an initiative to address the longstanding problems of tax avoidance and then separately of tax evasion. And we've proposed a number of mechanisms, but most immediately, the FATCA approach would essentially allow an exchange, an automatic exchange of information between tax authorities so that it would become impossible for domestic residents to essentially move their bank accounts offshore and not pay tax on it. That approach has been embraced by more countries than we would ever have anticipated. And we now are in a position where we're hearing demand from, we saw it in the G8 summit, and we are seeing it also in the OECD more broadly and in the G20. There is so much interest in concluding agreements for automatic exchange of tax information to reduce the scope for evasion that essentially we have to give a longer time, a longer runway for implementation. But this move towards FATCA for all, we think, should be viewed as a positive development. And it really does show the extent to which governments in the G20 are all focused on tax avoidance and tax evasion. I will say that this is going to be a continued subject for discussion. I expect that it will be a big focus in Moscow, not just on the automatic exchange of tax information in the case of FATCA for all, but also looking at measures to prevent base erosion and profit shifting to ensure that taxes are collected in the place that profits are actually generated. And we have a set of measures that we've taken there and we've proposed, and we're seeing there, too, broader and broader acceptance of them.
Thank you. Over there. Sir? You. Yes.
Thank you. Barry Wood from RTHK in Hong Kong. I would like to ask you, Ms. Brainard, is deflation a strong risk in Europe? And secondly, as you go to Moscow, is there an imperative now for the kind of coordinated stimulus we saw in 08 and 09?
So what I would say in Moscow is we do see the need for the G20 economies, the largest economies in the world, to have a shared view about what the most important challenges are on the global economy and to take action in their national contexts that are mutually supportive so that as we pursue growth in each economy, we support growth more generally. That's why we think that the central core tenet should be policies to support demand and growth, because by having all the G20 pursuing macroeconomic policies that support demand and jobs locally, that is the most mutually consistent set of macroeconomic policies that we think will lift growth and demand in the world globally. And that's why it's been so important at the G20 in February to come together around a strong exchange rate framework, again, to make sure that domestic policies were pursuing domestic objectives with domestic instruments and thereby pursuing mutually consistent win-win macroeconomic policies.
Thank you. Over there, please.
Thank you. Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. Ms. Brainard, you're aware that in Congress there's a growing feeling that the measures that have been taken for the so-called financial control, including the Dodd-Frank, are insufficient to stem the tide of the growing bubble, which, again, people feel are reviving. And therefore, last week, the Senate introduced a measure to reinstate the Glass-Steagall separation between commercial banks and investment banks in order to create a firewall which will protect our savings and protect grandma's savings from the investment bankers and the casino society that they operate. In the House, there are 70 supporters, 70 people who have written under a call for a return to Glass-Steagall. That includes many Democrats who have had to fight the White House on this issue because the White House has definitely not been in favor of that. But the groundswell for this from around the country, 22 state legislatures have introduced resolutions calling on the U.S. Congress to reinstate Glass-Steagall. This would mean that it would stem off the bubble economy, that the debt that has been accrued by the U.S. government through the bailout could be considered invalid and returned to the banks, and therefore there would be money available for the infrastructural projects that the country so badly needs. Why is the White House still opposed, given the feeling in the U.S. Senate and in the House of Representatives, to the Glass-Steagall reinstatement?
So let me just say that a lot of careful thought and deliberation has gone into both the set of statutory initiatives that were finalized under Dodd-Frank, and subsequent to that, the very careful and thorough rulemaking process that each of the regulatory agencies has taken forward from Dodd-Frank. I think if you look across all of those changes, and people, I think, forget to look at the cumulative impact of all those changes, they are nothing short of sweeping. You know, already we have seen our banks doubling the capital that they hold. They have new requirements on managing liquidity. We just saw our banking regulators coming out with even more demanding leverage requirement for the largest financial institutions. We have a new risk council, a systemic risk council that comprises all of the supervisors and regulators, and which is charged with designating systemically important financial institutions of any type, as well as for monitoring and responding to growing risks in the economy. We have seen derivatives regulated for the first time. On the shadow banking system, we are seeing the SEC moving forward with an incredibly important initiative in the area of money market funds. We're about to see agreement internationally on margins in derivatives that are not cleared, which again will go to pushing more derivatives onto central clearing. So if you look at that, you take the Volcker Rule, which is also being finalized. You take the Orderly Liquidation Authority, which for the first time gives our financial regulators the capacity to resolve in an orderly manner with no taxpayer money any financial institution of whatever size and whatever scope. Those things together are going to fundamentally change the way that banks operate, that our financial system operates. And I think we're only beginning because the rules will take some time to be put into effect and be fully implemented. We're only beginning to see the behavioral changes that will result from that comprehensive set of reforms.
Yes, sir, here, Franz.
Hi, thanks. I'm Jamie Strawbridge from Inside U.S. Trade. Ms. Brainerd, I thank you for doing this. I just wanted to follow up on two things you mentioned in your conversation. On the TTIP negotiations, you talked about not wanting TTIP to get in the way of financial services regulations. Could you just say a little more on why it might, you know, or what the potential problem is there, and if you see any way to avoid that? Because I know the European Union is very interested in including financial services regulations in the talks, so maybe if you could expand on that and say if there's a way to avoid. And then just a quick one on the BIT. I know this is a breakthrough. We're now going to go forward in the BIT talks with China. Do you think the model BIT language on state-owned enterprises is sufficient dealing with China, or do you think we might have to craft something totally new from the model BIT in that area? Thanks.
So with regard to the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership discussions, I think it's very important for us to recognize that it was in 2009 at the Pittsburgh Summit that the leaders came together and committed to a set of international financial reforms with deadlines, all within the next 1 to 2, in some cases at the max 3 years. So that takes us into 2012, and in some cases into 2013. Those standards really are conform in many respects to all the reforms that we're putting in place under Dodd-Frank. So essentially, we have our G20 and our Financial Stability Board partners all signed up for the same set of reforms that we signed up for here in the U.S. on Dodd-Frank, with very tight timelines, all of which really should be implemented this year, or finished being implemented by this year. Under those circumstances, our focus has to be on making sure all of our partners actually implement and not start a new set of discussions about a new set of rules with a new set of deadlines. We just saw the power of this approach last Thursday when the European Union and our markets regulator came together on a bilateral agreement on how to regulate the cross-border derivatives activity taking place on both sides of the Atlantic. It is precisely that kind of progress that needs to take place now in real time, and we don't want to see that set of discussions move to a different fora or delayed.
Thank you. This gentleman there, please. Yes.
Thank you very much. My name is Elliot Waldman. I'm with the Tokyo Broadcasting System. And I was wondering if you could sort of comment a little bit with regard to Japan getting ready to join the TPP negotiations. There have been a lot of vocal calls from people in Congress as well as interest groups that a strong set of provisions against currency manipulation be included. And I was wondering if you could comment on whether you think that's a workable option, and if not, if you think there are other kinds of ways around that issue. Thank you.
So on Japan, I would say that in February of this year, when finance ministers and central bank governors of the G7 first and the G20 met, they agreed a set of guidelines on the exchange rate frameworks in each of the G20 countries, which really went beyond what we had seen before. And in particular, G7 countries committed to pursue domestic objectives using domestic instruments and not target exchange rates. And of course, the G20 together agreed to not target exchange rates, to move to market-determined exchange rates, and to not pursue competitive devaluations. That set of agreements, we think, is very powerful. And of course, we have been closely watching the developments in Japan. We are interested to see how the three arrows of Prime Minister Abe's growth strategy will work together. We've put a lot of emphasis on that third arrow, and of course we haven't seen the full scope of reforms there yet. But what is important to us is that all of the members of the G20 and the G7 faithfully fulfill their commitments, and that we see in Japan's case their growth strategy operating through demand channels, domestic demand channels, and that is a really a touchstone for G20 member growth strategies to contribute to overall global growth.
In the back, please. The gentleman over there. Go ahead.
Thank you for doing this. My name is Kosuke Ito. I'm a reporter at the GG Press. I have a question about U.S. and China in strategic and economy dialogue. Both government agreed about the peer review of the financial service sector of financial system reform. Could you better elaborate about how do you proceed that kind of peer review about the financial reform? And also, do you think that kind of a mutual review about financial system reform should be discussed in a coming G20 meeting? And you know, do you think about such kind of a mutual review, specifically about the financial sector, should be conducted in a global base?
So let me just say that you know, what we learn from our Chinese colleagues in the Strategic and Economic Dialogue is that they are actively engaged on internal discussions about a set of reforms that will move their economy away from a resource-intensive, export-oriented, no longer sustainable, unbalanced growth model to one that is focused on China's domestic consumer, higher value, less resource-intensive, and one that we think holds out the promise to sustain growth in China and to provide opportunities more broadly, certainly to American companies and exporters, but also across the globe. In that set of reform discussions, there clearly is some determination to move forward on opening up the financial services sector and services sectors more generally, and that is something we saw both in the very significant shift in position on the bilateral investment treaty, also in the beginnings of discussions about the Shanghai Free Trade Investment Zone. But clearly, the reforms that are being discussed go beyond that to contemplate liberalization of interest rates so that capital is allocated according to market signals rather than rationed. There's clearly continued debate and discussion about unlocking dividends from China's state enterprises so that they don't sit within the state enterprise sector and provide an unlevel playing field, but are released for the greater benefit of the Chinese society. So those are the kinds of reforms that are being discussed. Of course, you'll hear more as our Chinese colleagues start to move forward on their reform agenda. And I think there will be a lot of interest in China's growth strategy and the reforms that it has underway as we move to the G20 in Moscow, because China just is such a big part of the system now that we see broad interest in sustained and balanced growth.
Lady here, please.
Hi, this is Anna Yukonona from Reuters. Thanks for taking my question. One thing you briefly talked about in the discussion was about some of the market volatility. And a big focus of the U.S., of course, is boosting domestic demand, but some emerging economies are also being affected by external shocks. So I was wondering, I mean, the IMF's growth forecast was partially downgraded because of the slowing growth in emerging economies. So I was wondering if you could talk about whether you see that as a risk to overall global growth, kind of some of these capital outflows that are hurting the economies. And the second question is a bit more specific, but the Civil 20 group recommended that income inequality should also be part of the G20's agenda for economic growth. It shouldn't just be about sustainability, but also income inequality. I was wondering what your position is on that. Thank you.
So let's see if I can remember the first one. So on having a hard time with the
capital outflows
with the multiple part questions here. So I apologize if I'm dropping some of them along the way. So with regard to the emerging markets, look, there is a substantial diversity, of course, among this group of what are termed emerging markets. If you look across them broadly, we see more resilience as a group. You know, sort of more flexibility in exchange rates, so more ability to allow shocks to be absorbed, as well as better buffers being built into many systems. That, of course, is the broad picture. Now, of course, there are some risks in emerging markets that you know we all are. More closely monitoring, and those are particularly in areas where political and economic risks may coincide. There are also areas where risks might, new exposures might be building up. There's a much greater, for instance, local currency denominated debt exposures than there have been previously. But, you know, again, as a group, there are many of the emerging markets that have substantial capacity still to support domestic demand and to contribute to global growth. And, of course, many of those are in the G20, and we'll continue to emphasize this. On this second issue you raise, we continue to emphasize inclusive growth. It's very important for us here in the U.S., for instance, to see middle incomes, middle class incomes growing. And that's really a focal point for the president and his economic team. And more broadly in the G20, we think it's very important to see countries adopting macroeconomic strategies that are inclusive, and that's why the focus this G20 on jobs and demand is so important.
So we have just a few minutes left. I'm going to take two questions. The gentleman here, please, and then you.
Liaquat Ahmed at Brookings Institution. I wanted to ask you about the role of the fund in Europe. When Europe first blew up in 2010, there was considerable debate about whether this was appropriate for the fund to get involved, and some countries argued that essentially Europe should be able to take care of itself. Now it's becoming, now it's emerging that there was actually considerable, the IMF has issued reports where they're beginning to question whether they did the right thing in Greece. So the question is, one, was it a mistake for us to get the IMF so involved in Europe? And secondly, going forward, do you detect any shift in thinking in Germany, which is essentially in the driving seat, about how to solve European problems?
So let me just say that obviously, you know, we have been supportive of the important role that the IMF has played in supporting Euro area partners. In particular, because the IMF brought and is bringing to the table, you know, a sort of unparalleled degree of experience with financial stabilization and technical expertise, and that has been extremely important to Europe. It's been important to us as well to make sure that the crisis response was as strong as it could be. You know, it is always easy to second guess once financial conditions have stabilized somewhat, decisions that are made at the height of a crisis. But what we learned from our crisis is it's critical to act with decisive force. And it is very important for Europe now to move from the financial stability gains that it has been made, which were very hard won, and move to a growth plan, a demand plan. And it's really for the euro area to decide how to take that forward. But it's important for the world, as well as for the euro area, to see a growing amount of ability to work together among the member states of the euro area, more fiscal integration, more banking integration, to complement the very substantial monetary integration that they have already committed to. And it's very important to see a much stronger focus on demand.
And one last question here, please. You.
Patrick Welter, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. I have two very short questions, Madam Brainard. The first is that in February there had been talks about a Toronto 2.0 agreement about some kind of deficit or debt goals in the G20. Is this finally off the table, or are you still talking about that? And the second question I have is, when you talk about tax avoidance and the OECD proposals about tax avoidance and international cooperation against tax avoidance, you don't talk about tax competition. Shouldn't companies and maybe even citizens should be much more worried that the G20 are building some kind of tax cartel and that it might be in the end they have to pay more taxes?
So let me see. Let me go back to the first question first. Fiscal. So look, I think, if you look at the U.S. fiscal trajectory, most international commentators would probably say the U.S. is probably doing a little too much fiscal consolidation. Certainly, the president would like to see a more balanced path of fiscal consolidation. But the reality is we have done a tremendous amount. We have achieved already approximately $2.5 trillion. Between the budget agreement that was reached between Congress and the administration, and of course, the tax agreement that was reached. We also have an additional approximately a little over $1.2 trillion. So we're getting close to the $4 trillion that we originally thought would be required to get our debt onto a declining path. And of course, the CBO has now put out numbers suggesting that we're on track to see our deficit fall to 4% of GDP this fiscal year, well ahead of what was anticipated. So to a large degree, the U.S. is very much on track. And our view is that creating some kind of additional uniform framework across members of the G20 who face very disparate situations really would be a step backward. And so, you know, our focus needs to be on what each country can do to strengthen demand. And given that different countries face very different circumstances, again, I think the lesson we take from our own recovery is it's very important to do course corrections along the way. And you don't want to see an excessively rigid framework prevent that. The second question was on tax competition. Thank you. So, look, I think it's very important, and I think citizens of countries all around the world, at a time when we're all trying to find the right balance in terms of supporting private demand and ensuring medium-term fiscal sustainability, that our companies and individuals actually pay taxes in the jurisdictions where they've made the earnings. And that's why the agreement that we've seen in the G8, that we're working on in the OECD and the G20, is one that I think is widely supported and welcomed because it is a set of mutually consistent practices and rules that simply assure that jurisdictions collect the taxes that legally they are owed.
Lael Brainard is the Undersecretary for International Affairs at the U.S. Treasury.
On behalf of the Carnegie Endowment, I want to thank Dr. Brainerd and all of you for this fascinating session. Thank you very much.